This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Nowhere Man by Greg Hurwitz, performed by Scott Brick. For Keith Kalla, an old-fashioned editor in all the best ways, and a new-fashioned editor in all the essential ones. How deep do you need to bury the past before it will stay dead? Alan Moore, Swamp Thing. The truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you. David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest. 1. What He Needs to Know. A naked selfie. It starts with that. Hector Contrell sends a 17-year-old kid to troll middle schools in East L.A. The kid, improbably named Addison, makes for fine bait. Seedily handsome, starter mustache, pop star cheekbones, dirty blonde hair flipped just so. He wears a hoodie and rides a skateboard, the better to look like he's 15. He says he's a pro skater with a contract. He says he's a rapper with a deal at a major label. He's really a pot-smoking dropout who lives in a rented garage with his older brother and his friends, spends his night playing Call of Duty, and hitting a green glass water bong named Fat Boy. He hangs out near campuses at lunch, after classes, his skateboard rat-a-tat-tatting across sidewalk cracks, just barely past school ground limits. The girls cluster and giggle, and he chooses one to peel off the herd. He tells her to snap pictures. He tells her to get a secret Facebook account, one her parents don't know about, and upload them there. He tells her that everyone does this in high school, and he's mostly right. But not everyone is hooked into a scheme like this. He targets Title I schools, broke girls, easily impressed, looking for a dream, a romance, a way out. Girls whose parents lack the resources to do much if they disappear. The secret Facebook page links go to Hector Contrell. The genius of it is, the girls create the sales catalog themselves. From Contrell, the links go to all sorts of men with unorthodox tastes. Austrian industrialists, sheiks. Three brothers in Detroit with a padlocked metal shed. Online, they can peruse the merchandise discreetly and, if need be, ask for more product information. Different photographic angles, specific poses. They make their selections. Given immigration confusion, gang influence, and splintered family trees, disappearances aren't rare when you're dealing with broke ethnic girls. They're a renewable resource. Hector Contrell comes in the black of night, and another girl vanishes off the streets and wakes up in a stupor in Islamabad or Birmingham or Sao Paulo. Some of the girls are kept. Some are designated for one-time use. Anna Rezian is the next prospect. Her father is a plumber, works hard, comes home late and tired. Her mother? A cocktail waitress, comes home later and more tired. Only 15, Anna takes care of her younger brothers and sisters, tries to remember to look at her textbooks after she gets the kids down. It's a hard routine for a girl her age. One day after school, Addison's blue eyes peer out from beneath his scraggly bangs and pick her, and only her. That night, she touches up her eyeliner, sheds the flat front dickies with the worn knees, checks the lighting. This choice, this moment, is going to be a portal to a whole new her. But after she uploads the selfie, nothing magical happens. Staring at the image she has released into the world, she feels an unease begin to gnaw at her. She decides to stop after the one photo. But Addison needs more. They've been requested from a buyer in Serbia. In a ganja haze, he catches her in the alley outside her family's one-bedroom apartment. When his low-rent hipster charms fail him, he tells her what she'd better do. Big-shotting in the Crenshaw night, he lets fly that he works for someone who will hurt her and her family if she turns off the tap. She stays up all night, trembling in the glow of her ancient laptop, clicking her way through the infinity of Facebook and chasing threads. Friends of friends have heard of friends who have disappeared. Over the top of the screen, she looks at her sleeping siblings and contemplates what it will feel like if harm befalls them because of her stupidity. She looks at her sleeping parents, exhausted after their long work days. The chasm of guilt inside her widens by the second, pushing her further and further away until she is on an island of her own making, until her family members seem like specks on the horizon. Something awful is coming, either for them or for her. She makes the choice. She sends new photos. She stops sleeping. She starts plucking out her hair in patches. She cuts herself at school, hoping the pain will wake her from this nightmare. Maybe it's a cry for help instead, each crimson line across her forearm a smoke signal, released in hopes that someone will ride to her rescue. Someone does see the signal. One of her classmates' fathers, an older man with a cane and a fresh limp, finds her sobbing in the bathroom of a 7-Eleven when she's supposed to be in homeroom. He gives her a phone number, 1-855-2-NOWHERE. A magical fix-it line. She dials. Evan Smoke picks up. "Do you need my help?" he asks. That's how it works. 14 hours later, Evan is standing outside Addison's rented garage. The air tastes of car exhaust. The streetlights are broken, the stars smeared by smog, the night dark as tar. Evan is a wraith. Addison's brother Carl and his crew of friends are out scoring black tar at a park in Boyle Heights. Evan knows this. Addison is alone. Evan knows this, too. He has done his research. The first commandment, assume nothing, demands it. The wraith raises a single knuckle, taps the garage door. A moment later, it creaks upward. Stooped, Addison emerges from an effluvium of day-old bong water. He rocks on his heels, gauging Evan. By design, Evan is hard to gauge. 30-something. Fit, but not muscly. Somewhere around 6 feet. An average guy. Not too handsome. Addison underestimates him. This happens a lot. Also by design. The kid's lips twitch to the side. He jerks his head, flips his hair out of the blue eyes that have landed many a young woman on a container ship heading for uncharted waters. "The fuck you want?" he says. "Hector Contrell's address," Evan says. The pretty boy lashes flare, but Addison covers quickly. "No idea who that is, and no fucking way I'd tell you if I did." Evan looks through him. This tends to make people uneasy. Uncertainty washes over Addison's face, but he blinks it away. "I know people, you tool," he says. "People who can make you disappear like that." The snap of his fingers, sharp in the crisp air. "Who the fuck you think you are anyways?" "The nowhere man," Evan says. The kid's Adam's apple jerks once. Up, down. The moniker is not widely known, but dark rumors have spread through certain streets, like trash blown down graffitied alleys. Addison takes a quick step to the side to stabilize himself. His voice comes out husky, pushed through a constricting throat. That's just a bullshit story. Then you don't have to be scared, do you? Addison doesn't say anything. You do know what happens to the girls, Evan tells him. It takes a moment for Addison to relocate his voice. They disappear. To where? I don't know. Guys. Who use them for? The kid shrugs, actually muffles a snicker. Whatever guys do. The address. I can't tell you. Hector will kill me. Literally kill me. Evan's gaze is steady. Addison falters. No, he says, a new realization dawning. Oh, no. Look, I'm just a kid, man. I'm 17. You're not going to kill me, are you? There is a punch Evan was taught in his early teens by a gruff Marine close-quarter combat instructor. It is called the pallet breaker, a non-lethal blow that fractures the bridge of the nose, the sinus bones, and both orbital sockets, splitting the skull horizontally, temple to temple. It leaves the upper jaw floating, unattached. Evan's gaze narrows. He picks his spot. You wouldn't have thought the kid could keep his feet. But there he is, upright on the curb. Something like drool leaks from his lips, the holes of his nose. No, Evan says, I won't kill you. Addison makes a wheezing noise. With his new face, it will be hard for him to troll for girls anymore. The address, Evan says again. What is left of the mouth tells him what he needs to know. 2. The Social Contract. Evan slipped through the plastic tarp into a new construction McMansion, the spoils of Hector Contrell's war on the broke families of East L.A. The house, distanced from its neighbors, topped an inclined driveway at the edge of Chatsworth. Evan drifted through doorless frames, making silent progress toward the heart of the house. Studs framing the wide halls and exposed ceiling beams gave him the impression that he was walking into a massive rib cage, into Hector Contrell himself. Sawdust chalked the back of Evan's throat. Nails protruded from the floor, poking the soles of his original SWAT boots. The aggressively checkered gunner grips of a custom Wilson Combat 1911 pistol bit the flesh of his palm. He found Contrell in the living room to be, ensconced like a pilot within a cockpit of computer monitors and servers from which he ran his flesh empire with impunity. A burly, bearded man wholly unhooked from the social contract, who took what he wanted because he wanted it. The high-tech station, with its bluish glow and snaking cables, seemed anomalous, sprouting up like a mushroom from the exposed subfloor. Hector noticed movement in the shadows and stood, revolver quickly in hand. For a time, it seemed, he kept rising. Standing just past the semicircle of pushed-together desks, Evan looked up at him. A fuck you tattoo on the front of Hector's neck indicated that nuance was not the man's strong suit. Hector said, I don't know who you are or why you're here, but I'm going to give you 5 seconds to leave before I aerate your torso. For emphasis, he kicked one of the monitors off the desk, which went to pieces at Evan's feet, sparking impressively. Both men kept their guns down at their sides. Evan watched the monitor give off a dying spark. Then he lifted his eyes. One of the functions of anger is to convince people of the seriousness of your intentions, he said, to signal that you're out of control, unpredictable, willing to do damage, to evoke fear. Hector drew himself even taller. No minor feat. Backlit by the monitors, his meaty left earlobe showed a missing slot where an earring had been ripped free. Evan took a step closer. So look at me. Look at me closely. and ask yourself, "Do I look scared?" The big man leaned in, the glow of the computers turning his face into a shadow-ravaged landscape. Empty eye sockets, pronounced jowls, the curve of one cheek. His thick lips pulsed, the first show of hesitation. Evan's gun remained at his side, just like Hector's. They faced each other across the desk. When Evan was 14, Jack had trained him how to fast draw. It wasn't with high noon theatrics, unholster, lift, and aim. It was a 2 millimeter tilt and 3.5 pounds of index finger pressure. The shadows shifted across Hector's face. His beefy hand twitched around his gun. He moved first. The plywood walls gave off a good echo. Later that night, Evan eased into the alley that ran behind the dilapidated apartment that accommodated Anna Razian's family. A sheen of blood had hardened on his left forearm, cracking like dried mud when he moved. He'd washed his hands and his face, but could feel the leftover flecks on the side of his neck. There'd been back spray. He lifted his black phone from his pocket. It was a Rome's Own model, encased in fiberglass and tough black rubber, the screen protected by Gorilla Glass. He kept it on him, always. It was a lifeline. Not to him, but to those who called it. He sent a text to Anna. Outside. As he waited, a concern niggled at the base of his skull. He had seen something in Hector's house. He didn't know what it was, but it was wrong. Was his client in danger? No. He'd been thorough. Not a threat to her. Not a threat to him. Something else. Something important, but not immediate. Anna's backlit silhouette appeared at the mouth of the alley about 10 yards away. She wore a nightie, her spine hunched, her dry hair sticking out. The alley formed a wind tunnel, the October air whipping at her brunette tufts, making them wag stiffly. "You're safe now," he told her. Her feet were bare. He could see the tremble in her knees.
"I thought you were one of them coming to get me," she said. "I thought walking down here would be the last thing I ever did. But then it was you."
"I'm sorry I scared you," he said.
"What does it mean?"
"That I'm safe."
"You don't have to worry anymore," he said.
"About what?" "Any of it."
"Edison?"
"Has other concerns now."
"And his boss? The guy behind it all?"
"He died." Anna trudged forward, her scalp shiny in the spots where she'd plucked out her hair. Her face held the same look he'd seen in his other clients, a worn-through, hollowed-out expression that came from falling out of the slipstream of life.
"Albert is safe?"
Her voice cracked.
"And Edward?"
"Yes." Anna came closer yet, her cheeks glinting.
"How about Maria? They won't hurt Maria."
"There's no one left to hurt Maria." Openly sobbing now.
"Merrick? Heyrig?"
"Your mother and father will be fine." He thought of her family in their beds and wondered at the serenity they might offer her. At her age, he hadn't had much, which meant he'd had nothing to leave behind. As a 12-year-old, he'd stepped off a truck stop curb into a dark sedan and blipped off the radar. Back then, any gamble was worth the taking. This one had gotten him out of East Baltimore. He'd been to Marrakesh and St. Petersburg and Cape Town, and he'd left his mark in blood at every stop. But he'd never had what Anna had waiting for her upstairs. The chill breeze brought with it the realization that he'd devoted his life to preserving for others what he couldn't have himself.
"The pictures of me," she said. "They'll be so ashamed."
Before leaving Hector's place, Evan had safed the house, finding little more than construction materials, empty beer bottles, a few hefty dumbbells in the garage, Fast food wrappers layered a mattress thrown on the floor in one of the bare-bones rooms upstairs, where Hector was living during the construction. Evan had gone back down to the comms center and dragged the considerable body out of the way. Once the cockpit was clear, he spent a few stomach-churning minutes navigating the databases, clicking through the files of past eligibles to locate the matching buyers. Client information was sparse and coded, but he forwarded it on to the local FBI field office. But not before wiping all information about Anna Resian off the servers. "The pictures are gone," Evan said. "No one will have to know anything." Anna took an unsteady step to the side and lifted a hand to the cracked stucco wall.
"Edward, he's safe now. He's safe."
Still working it through, thawing out of denial. "You're all safe." Anna's face wobbled, and for a moment it seemed she might come apart entirely.
"I don't know how I can face them, knowing what I almost did to us all. I'll never forgive myself."
"That's up to you." She looked stung by his response. Tears clung to her lashes. She bit her lips. Her chest rose, her nostrils flaring. Deep breath. Exhale. The tears did not fall. "You're not to call me again," Evan said. "Do you understand? This is what I do. But it's all that I do."
"Albert and Maria are okay now?"
Her lips barely moved, her voice little more than a whisper.
"Mayrick and Hayrick and Edward. Edward."
"Anna, I need you to focus. Look at me. Look at me. I have one thing to ask of you before I leave." Her eyes found a sudden clarity.
"Anything."
"Find someone who needs me, like you did. It doesn't matter if it takes a week or a month or a year. You find someone who is desperate and has no way out. Give them my number."
"Yes. 1-855-2-NOWHERE.
Every call was digitized and sent over the Internet through a series of encrypted virtual private network tunnels. After pinging through 15 software virtual telephone switch destinations around the globe, it came through his roam zone. "Yes. You tell them about me."
"Like Nicole Helfrich's dad when he found me in the 7-Eleven?"
"Like that. You find someone. Tell them I'll be there on the other end of the phone." That was the final step for his clients. A task, a purpose, an act of empowerment that transitioned them from victim to rescuer. Evan knew all too well that some wounds never healed. Not fully. But there were ways to contain the pain, to take ownership over the scars. And this was one of them. Anna lunged at him and wrapped him in a hug. For a moment, his arms floated a few inches above her thin back. He was unaccustomed to this kind of contact. In the moonlight, he could see the wine-colored streak on his forearm, the dark half-moons beneath his nails. He didn't want Hector Contrell's blood on her clothes, in her hair. And yet, Anna's embrace tightened, her face pressed into his chest. He lowered his arms. She was warm. He felt the wetness of her cheek through his t-shirt. She clung to him. Her voice became muffled.
"How do I thank you?"
Evan said, "Be with your family." He'd meant it as the next instruction, but it struck him that it was also the answer to her question. She stepped back to wipe her eyes, and he took the opportunity to slip away. 3. War Machine. Lurching from stoplight to stoplight, Evan dreamed of vodka. He had a new bottle tucked into the ice drawer of his Sub-Zero, waiting to greet him when he got home. From the outside, his Ford F-150 pickup looked like any one of the millions on the roads of America. But with its laminate armor glass, self-seal tires, and built-to-spec push-bumper assembly, It was actually a war machine. Up ahead, his building came into view, branded with the inflated title of Castle Heights, the residential tower pinned down the easternmost spot on the Wilshire Corridor, giving his penthouse condo an unbroken view of downtown Los Angeles. Castle Heights was posh but dated, as easily overlooked as Evan's truck, or Evan himself. Recruited out of the projects of East Baltimore as a kid, he'd spent 7 grueling years training under the tutelage of his handler. To say that Jack Johns had been like a father to him was an understatement. Jack had been the first person to treat Evan like he was human. Evan had been created by the Orphan Program, a deep black project buried inside the Department of Defense. It had identified the right kind of boys lost in the system of foster homes, covertly culled them one by one, and trained them to do what the U.S. government could not officially do in places where it could not officially be. A fully deniable antiseptic program run off a shadow budget. Technically, orphans did not even exist. They were expendable weapons. As Orphan X, Evan had been given bursting bank accounts in non-reporting countries. His assignment spanned more than a decade. Rarely sighted, never captured, he was known only by the dead high-value targets he left in his wake, and the alias he'd earned for moving unseen among the shadows. The Nowhere Man. At one point, though, he'd wanted out. It had cost him dearly. But it had left him with virtually unlimited money, a rare skill set, and time on his hands. And while he was done being Orphan X, he'd discovered that there was still work he should do as the Nowhere Man. Pro bono work. He'd lost the government designation, but kept the alias given to him by his enemies. Evan had heard that the Orphan Program had been dismantled, but last year he'd discovered that it was still operational. The most merciless of the orphans had taken over. Charles Van Sciver. His new directive. To track down and eliminate former orphans. According to those holding Van Sciver's leash, Evan's head contained too much sensitive information to remain connected to his body. One thing had been made clear in their last bloody confrontation. Van Sciver and his orphans would not stop the hunt until Evan was dead. In the meantime, Evan stayed off the grid and stayed vigilant. At last he finished the gauntlet crawl through Wilshire Boulevard traffic. Turning into Castle Heights, he whipped through the porte cochere past the valet and descended to the subterranean parking lot, drifting into his spot between 2 concrete pillars. He grabbed a black sweatshirt from the back, tugged it on to cover the dried blood on his arm, and headed across the floor. He always took a moment outside the lobby door to close his eyes, draw in a breath, and ready himself for the transition into his other persona. Evan Smoke, importer of industrial cleaning supplies. Another boring tenant. Given the hour, the lobby was quiet, the air fragrant with the scent of lilies. Evan crossed briskly to the elevator, nodding at the security guard. Evening, Joaquin. Joaquin looked up from the bank of monitors running live feeds from the building's perimeter and hallways. Castle Heights prided itself on its security, an additional selling point to attract moneyed middle-aged tenants and flush retirees.
Evening, Mr. Smoke. You have a good night.
Typical Saturday, Evan said. Burgers with the guys. Joaquin controlled the elevators from behind the high counter, another safety measure, and his shoulders dipped as he pressed the button for the car. Evan lifted a hand in thanks, noticed the flecks of dried blood beneath his fingernails, and lowered it quickly. He stepped inside, the button for the 21st floor already lit. The doors were just sliding closed when he heard a familiar voice call out, "Wait! Hold the elevator, Joaquin, please!" The patter of footsteps.
I meant the please to come first, so I didn't sound all ordery, but...
The doors parted again, and Evan came face to face with Mia Hall. Her sleeping 9-year-old was slumped in her arms, his chin resting on her shoulder. Mia's eyes rose to meet Evan's, and she froze. She was rarely caught off guard, but now her mouth was slightly ajar, a flush coming up beneath the faint scattering of freckles across the bridge of her nose. They'd had an almost relationship last year. He'd saved her life, and she'd saved his ass. In the process, she'd learned more about him than she should have, which would have been a problem, even if she hadn't been a DA for the city of Los Angeles. They blinked at each other. She shifted, straining under Peter's weight. "Want me to take him?" Evan asked. There was a time when that would have been normal.
"No," she said. "Thanks, I got him."
They rode up to her floor in silence. Remembering the traces of blood beneath his nails, Evan curled his hands into loose fists. He caught the faintest whiff of lemongrass, the scent of Mia's lotion. Peter's cheek was smooshed into a half-pout, his blonde hair stuck up on one side, his lips blue with lollipop residue. When the doors parted with an arthritic rattle, Peter lifted his head sleepily. The smile touched his charcoal eyes first, then his mouth.
"Hi, Evan Smoke,"
his voice, even raspier than usual. Before Evan could answer, the boy's lids drooped shut again. Mia carried him out, and Evan watched them walk up the corridor until the closing elevator doors wiped them from view. 4. Clean as a scalpel. When Evan turned the key, the lock to condo 21A unbolted with a clank, various security bars releasing within the steel door concealed behind the homey wood-paneled facade. As Jack used to say, ball bearings within ball bearings. Evan muted the alarm and walked to the kitchen area. He passed the living wall, a drip-fed vertical garden that sprouted mint and sage, parsley and chamomile. The pleasing scent and splash of green were the sole aspects of the corner penthouse that could be described as cheerful. The floor plan was largely open, 7,000 square feet of poured concrete split by workout stations, sitting areas, a freestanding fireplace, and a steel staircase that twisted up to a loft. Countless safeguards hid inside the sleek modern space, the windows and sliding glass doors that turned two walls into a city panorama, bullet-resistant Lexan armed with shatter detection software, the periwinkle retractable sunscreens, woven titanium armor, the quartz rock-layered balconies cupping the sides of the condo, secondary alarms rigged to detect the audio signature of an unwelcome guest's boots compressing the stones. Evan slipped around the island to the Sub-Zero, nestled among the ice cubes. A fat bottle of Carlson's Gold beckoned, the handcrafted Swedish vodka, comprising 7 kinds of potatoes, was uniquely made, distilled a single time through a copper-lined still. Evan poured a few fingers into a rocks glass over a spherical ice cube and garnished the drink with a single twist of ground pepper from a stainless steel mill. Clean as a scalpel up front, hint of mineral on the finish, lingering bite of pepper. Perfect. Evan walked to the fireplace, fired up the pyre of cedar logs, then pulled off his mission clothes and fed them to the flames. With the rocks glass dangling at his side, he padded naked across the vast space and down the brief hall, passing the spot where his dear, departed 19th-century katana used to hang. The bare wall hooks reminded him that he'd recently won an online bid for a replacement samurai sword, one that dated back to the early Edo period. The shipment was due to arrive soon from the Seki auction house. He stepped through his bedroom into the bathroom and tapped the frosted glass shower door, which recessed into the wall on silent tracks. Turning the water up as hot as he could stand, he ducked into the stream. He scrubbed. The water ran dark, a crimson swirl circling the drain. It took a wire brush and some effort to get his fingernails clean. After drying off, he headed into the bedroom and dressed in the same outfit he'd worn before. Dark jeans, gray V-necked T-shirt. Before turning away from the dresser, he hesitated over the bottom drawer. Emotion came up under his skin, a flush of heat. He tugged the drawer open and used his thumbnail to lift the false bottom. Beneath, a blue flannel shirt, blackened with old blood. Jack's blood. There wasn't a night in the past 8 years that Evan didn't turn off the light, close his eyes, and watch Jack bleed out in his arms. Evan shut the drawer and rose, trying to dissipate the tightness in his chest. He sat on his bed, a maglev that literally floated 2 feet off the floor, the slab held airborne by neodymium rare earth magnets. Closing his eyes, suspended between floor and ceiling, he focused on his breathing, dropped inside his body, felt the weight of his bones inside his flesh. It usually helped him find tranquility. But not tonight. Images strobed through the darkness behind his eyelids. Hector Contrell's shoulders jerking back as if yanked by strings, ink pooling in the hollow of his neck, a punctuation mark for the fuck you tattoo. Those mighty legs collapsing, a slow-motion avalanche crumble, the mess on the floor upstairs around the mattress, residue-stained styrofoam ramen bowls, empty burrito wrappers, crumpled protein packets. The rib cage of the house, bare studs scrolling by as Evan crept inside. The hall telescoping out like some Kubrickian horror, each empty doorframe replaced by another and another. Evan's eyes flew open. No doors. Which meant no door handles. That was what had been nagging at him. The house was open to the world, fluttering tarps in place of walls. No locked area for the kidnapped girls. The logistics of moving them around the world were complicated. There had to be a holding area somewhere off premises, which meant the possibility existed that another young woman remained in it. Evan hopped off the bed and moved back into the bathroom, stepping into the shower. He squeezed the lever handle for the hot water, and a moment later came a faint click. The lever, keyed to his palm print, doubled as a doorknob. He turned it the wrong way, and a door, disguised by the tile pattern of the shower wall, swung inward. He stepped into the vault. 400 asymmetrical square feet, crowded by the underbelly of the public stairs to the roof. The walled-off storage space served as Evan's armory and ops center. From the weapon lockers to the sheet-metal desk burdened with monitors, servers, and cables, it contained all the tools of his trade. The screens displayed pirated security feeds of Castle Heights, every hallway, every stairwell, every access door. He breathed in the smell of damp concrete, dropped into his chair and rolled to the L-shaped desk to access the law enforcement databases. All the major criminal and civil records, forensic files and ballistics registers, anything that the local police could dig up on the Panasonic Toughbook laptops wired into their patrol cars, Evan could access. His training had consisted of learning a little bit about everything from people who knew everything about something. He was hardly an expert hacker, but he'd broken into a few cruisers and uploaded a piece of reverse SSH code into their laptops, a back door for him to get into the system any time he beckoned. He beckoned now, searching Contrell's known associates, past residences, former cellmates. Nothing raised a red flag. A few hours later, the watered-down vodka sat forgotten beside the mousepad, pepper grinds floating like ash. Through the DMV site, Evan grabbed the license plate number of Contrell's Buick Enclave. Another series of backstage maneuvers got him into the vehicle's GPS records. He printed out the data captures, longitudes and latitudes listed in an endless scroll. As the laser jet spit out page after page, he started breaking down the pauses between the enclave's movements. Contrell's destinations. Evan's work was not done. The 10th commandment. Never let an innocent die.
5. The eyes of the data mining beast. The room could have been anywhere, midway up a high rise, at the distal end of a mansion's wing, underground even. It was big, the size of a movie theater, but without the rows of chairs. There wasn't a screen. There were hundreds of them. Lining three walls, stacked top to bottom, the most elaborate display of computing power this side of DARPA. Each monitor scrolled an endless stream of code. The screens were the eyes of the data mining beast. The banks of servers bunkered behind the bomb-resistant fourth wall were the brain. Guttering light from the monitors strobed across the dim room, living camouflage. It was hard to see anything aside from the screens. Everything melted together. The rugs, the consoles, the sparse furniture. Even the few visitors with clearance to enter, usually a not fully read-in engineer making tech adjustments, seemed to disappear, fish blending into rippling water. Charles Van Sciver liked it in here. Liked it for the darkness, through which he could drift alone and unseen. There were no windows, no mirrors either, not even in the adjoining bathroom. He'd covered them up. The occasional visitor was made to stand at a distance, so Van Sciver could stay bathed in the protective anonymity of the flickering lights. It was safe and contained in here. Just him and his algorithms. It wasn't fair to say that all the computing power was directed at locating Orphan X. Only 75%. Or 76.385, to be precise. After all, as the head of the program, Van Sciver did have other mission responsibilities. But none as important as this. For better than a decade, Evan had been the top asset in the entire orphan program. He didn't merely know where the bodies were buried. He had buried most of them. Though the naked eye couldn't process a sliver of the information whipping across the monitors, Van Sciver liked to watch the large-scale data processing in real time. Though he knew the buzzwords, cluster analysis, anomaly detection, predictive analytics, he couldn't even comprehend what was before him. But he could grasp the output reports, which he checked meticulously on the hour, searching for filaments in the ocean of cyberspace. These threads of the nowhere man had to be delicately backtraced. If Van Sciver allowed the slightest quiver showing that he had something on the hook, the line would snap. Lately, his team of engineers had been focused on data warehousing, piecing together bits of information from offshore bank accounts, trying to reconstruct enough of the mosaic to point them the right direction. They had leads on Evan, of course, a few floating strands on the water. But every time they tugged slack out of the line, they came up with more slack. A money transfer zigzagging off into the depths, a shell corp vanishing behind a mailbox corporation, another trail ending at a disused P.O. box off some dusty third-world dirt road. Van Sciver paced the perimeter of the room, his ever-paler skin drinking in the antiseptic blue glow of the screens. The lack of human contact ensured that he would never be deterred from his goal. Ultimately, it would come down to discipline and abstinence, and so he had cleared out any distracting clutter from his existence. His willingness to deny all pleasure and warmth was why he would win. That was why he would beat his nemesis.
victory would be pleasure enough.
Van Sciver halted. Facing the horseshoe of the rippling walls, he basked in the power represented before him. Time was meaningless in here. The present was spent reconstructing the past and extrapolating the future, a dragon ever swallowing its tail, an infinity of numbers that summed to zero. But one day, they would add up to everything. One day, they would search out the right thread of ones and zeros that would lead to Orphan X. It was only a matter of time.
6. Strock Oil.
Evan noticed everything when he drove, especially gray Ford Transit Connect vans with no side windows and dealer plates, like the one that had been hovering in his rearview mirror for the past few blocks. He threw on his right-hand turn signal. The van did not. Either it wasn't following him, or it was driven by a pro unwilling to take the bait. Evan drove straight past the entrance of the Norwalk FedEx office, and the van kept right on behind him. Evan muted the signal, keeping his head down, but his eyes nailed to the rear view. He waited a few beats, and then abruptly veered off onto a side street. The van coasted by, not even slowing. He could never be too careful. He'd spent the morning completing a circuit of the safe houses he kept in the greater Los Angeles area, testing his loadout gear, checking the oil on his alternate vehicles, changing up the automated lighting. At his Westchester place, a crappy single-story beneath LAX's flight path, he'd switched out his usual rig for a mud-spattered 4Runner with a scuba flag sticker in the back window. On the side street now, Evan sat behind the wheel and watched the road for a while. Finally, he dropped the transmission back into drive. Backtracking to the FedEx office, he entered, signed a series of customs forms, and left with an elongated cardboard box. His new katana. This blade had been forged relatively recently, in 1653, by Heike Norihisa, last smith of the five-layered smelt. The katana was decorative, as Evan had intended the last one to be, and he was eager to mount it on the empty hooks in his hall. But he had another location to check first. He'd spent hour after excruciating hour parsing the data from Contrell's GPS, checking the man's frequent stops, searching for the location where he stored the girls before shipping them out. With every passing day, more sand trickled through the hourglass. Evan drove to Fullerton. A sheaf of papers rested in his lap, much of the data on them already crossed out with red pen. The next place on the list proved to be a humble residence, semi-isolated behind a stretch of soccer fields gone to dirt. Detached garage, new shingles, fresh paint, curtains drawn. A security gate guarded a concrete front walk hemmed in by flower beds. A Stepford house, writ small. Evan parked several blocks away and doubled back. He vaulted the fence, put his ear to the door. Heard nothing. The lock gleamed, a shiny Medico. He raked it with a triple mountain pick, feeling for the rhythm of the wafers inside as they lifted to different heights. At last, he felt the pleasing click of the release. The well-greased door swung in on silent hinges. He drew his Wilson from his Kydex high-guard hip holster and eased inside. The interior, dim from the drawn curtains, stank of cleaning solution and unventilated air. Though he sensed that the place was empty, he moved silently from room to room. It was cheaply constructed and surprisingly clean. Dishes neatly stacked on a spotless counter, sparkling linoleum floors, IKEA-looking slip-covered couch and chairs, calming taupes, distressed blues. In the living room, he parted the curtains with a hand. The windows were nailed shut. He ran his fingers over the heads of the nails, the metal cool against his prints. His heart rate ticked up with anticipation. He moved on. The master bedroom featured two double beds, sheets neatly made. Men's clothes in a wardrobe. Big men's clothes. One of the jackets looked like it could cover a deck chair. Evan stopped, breathed, listened. Then he started down the tiny hall to the rear room. Three door bolts. On the outside. Pistol drawn, Evan stood perfectly still outside the room for a full 10 minutes. No sounds of breathing within. No creaking of the floorboards. Finally, he threw one bolt. The muted clank of metal against metal might as well have been a clap of thunder. Standing to the side of the door, he waited. Nothing happened. And then more nothing. The next two locks he unbolted in rapid succession. He bladed his body, let the door creak inward. Leading with the 1911, he nosed around the jamb. A nicely made bed, lavender comforter, brand new TV on a stand. A lovely room, aside from the plate of sheet metal drilled over the window. When Evan shouldered the door to step inside, he felt it to be heavier than the others. Solid core. The holding pen. No one inside. The room, bare, pristine, equipped with only the basics, seemed like a diorama. In fact, the whole place had a dollhouse feel. It had been designed with one purpose in mind. Comfortable functionality. Hector Contrell had to ensure that the merchandise wasn't damaged before delivery. The bathroom door remained closed. Evan tried the doorknob, but it didn't budge. Seating the pistol in his holster, he took out his tension wrench again. The cheaper lock required only a hook pick and a few jiggles. As the door swung inward, the smell hit him first. A smooth leg, mottled blue-purple, hooked over the brim of the bathtub. A mass of tangled black hair covered the face, leaving only a delicate ivory chin exposed. He put the body as older than most of Contrell's eligibles. Late teens, early 20s. Probably designated for a buyer looking for variety. Until Contrell's operation had been blown, and his middlemen decided to liquidate the inventory. She'd been alive when he killed Contrell. She'd been alive when he went home and poured himself a glass of vodka and drank to a job well done. Evan lowered the pick set. That was when he heard the footsteps behind him. Two men, no doubt the inhabitants of the roomy clothes in the wardrobe of the master bedroom. The one nearest Evan gripped a snub-nosed Smith & Wesson cheap special and gripped it well. Firmed wrists, locked elbows. A second pistol hung in a cheap nylon holster underneath his left armpit, semi-auto backup in case 5 bullets weren't sufficient. The man behind him carried a healthy gut and a Sig Sauer. His gun was also raised, but he could afford to be less on point given that his buddy had Evan pinned down. Evan couldn't get a clear look around the front man's barrel chest. The man seemed to block everything out. It wasn't just his girth, but the way he canted in aerodynamically at Evan, thrusting chin, ledged brow, chest and biceps tugging him forward on his frame so it seemed that only the balls of his feet were holding him back. A bullet train made incarnate. "Who's been sleeping in our beds?" he said. Evan lowered his hands slightly. The S&W followed the motion, stopped level with his heart. "Goldilocks," Evan said. "Really?"
"I gotta agree, Claude," the man by the door said. "Not your finest work."
Claude's features rearranged themselves. His cheeks looked shiny, as if he'd recently shaved, but stubble was already pushing its way through again. His face, the target demographic for 5-blade razors.
"I just thought, you know, the whole breaking and entering thing," Claude said. "Us coming home, catching you. Plus, the Goldilocks reference, it's demeaning."
"Because she's a girl," Evan said. Claude nodded. Evan held his hands in place. "You know what they say. If you have to explain the joke. The man in the back flicked his cig at Evan.
Gun on the ground.
Evan complied. As he squatted, he gauged the distance to the tips of Claude's shoes. Maybe 5 feet. Evan could close the space in a single lunge. Easy enough. If he didn't have two guns aimed at his critical mass. Rising, he eyed the barrel of the chief's special. Since Claude was muscle-bound and right-handed, Evan's first move would be to juke left, make him swing the gun inward across that barrel chest. The compression of delt and peck might slow his arm, by Evan a half-second. That would be all he'd need. His stare dropped to Claude's second gun, the one slung in the loose-fitting underarm holster. A Browning high power. It was cocked and locked. Hammer back, safety engaged. The safety lever peeked out beneath the retention strap of the nylon holster. Good presentation. The odor wafted from the bathroom over Evan's shoulder, precipitating on the taste buds at the back of his tongue. Just past the threshold in the hall, he saw the bright red of a few plastic gasoline jugs. The men had set them down quietly. You guys cleaning up the operation?
Contrell was the CEO, Claude said. We're just workaday guys. Glorified babysitters, really. Sit around, eat pizza, watch the tube. Beats digging ditches.
Evan flipped the tiny hook pick around his thumb, pinched it again. Those were the only options, huh? Sell girls or dig ditches? Claude smiled with sudden awareness, his magnificent jaw jutting out all the more.
You're the guy who put us out of work.
With a flick of his wrist, Evan flipped the hook pick at Claude's eyes, lunging left just before the gunshot. The bullet cracked past his ear. He dove not so much at Claude as into him, using him as a shield, getting inside the range of the revolver. Evan's right hand flew at that Browning in the underarm holster, and then he smacked into the big man, pressing chest to chest, a dance move gone wrong. It happened very fast. Evan's thumb shoved the safety lever off as his forefinger curled around the trigger. He rode the gun back in the sling and fired straight through the holster from beneath Claude's armpit. The man behind them took the shot through the cheek, blood welling like struck oil. The pistol in his fist barked twice as he flew back. Evan felt both impacts ripple Claude's flesh. Friendly fire smacks to the spine. Claude dropped fast and lay still. The other man had wound up sitting next to the bed, slumped forward over his gut, one hand clutching the lavender comforter. A perfect stillness claimed the room. The whole thing had gone down in about a second and a half. Evan picked up his gun and started out. Though the neighboring houses were far, the noise of a firefight would carry. As he stepped over Claude, he noticed a yellow slip peeking from the inner lapel pocket of the laid-open jacket. Instinct halted him there above the body, told him to crouch and reach for it. He teased it out. A customer copy of a shipping bill, rendered on thin yellow carbonless copy paper. All at once, the air felt brittle, as if it might shatter if he moved wrong. His eyes pulled to the bed. Queen size. Big enough for roommates. He looked back at the form, taking in the data. Origin, Long Beach, California. Destination, Jacksonville, Florida. ETA, October 29th, 11:37 p.m. Distance, 5,141.11 miles, 8,273.82 kilometers. That was not the distance a package would travel by truck or plane. Not even close. That distance would be 2,000 miles and change. This package was traveling down around the bottom of the continent and through the Panama Canal. He scanned farther down the form. Sure enough. A 20-foot ISO standard container had been secured on a mid-size bulk carrier called the Horizon Express. An additional port fee of $120 was to be paid upon delivery to the Jacksonville Port Authority. At the bottom of the form,